Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to yet another exciting episode of the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live on American Freedom Radio for the listening discomfort of those who enjoy this thing called a bubble of ignorance that they sit inside, really comfortable in it for some reason. Hey, when was the last time you had an aha moment, you know, like something that made you change your life in some way or change who you are or maybe even question who you are at any point? You haven't had one since you can last remember, eh? Oh, okay. Do you watch a lot of TV? Yeah. Oh, yeah. You listen to a lot of mainstream talk radio, huh? Yeah, yeah. You listen to mainstream pop songs? Yeah? Okay. Do you read anything that isn't manufactured by a cartel of scumbaggery lying scum? Yeah, no? Oh, okay. Well, you see, there's this whole other, you know, thing called the world that is beyond your friggin' imagination that apparently you wouldn't be able to figure out if you just sat there listening to what people spoon feed you. Stuff that makes you kind of feel really comfortable. People like to use this argument. It's called Occam's Razor. If there are two possibilities, one of them sounds perfectly reasonable and one of them sounds a little bit crazy, the perfectly reasonable one is probably the one that's true. I prefer to use Fuckham's Razor. If there's two possibilities, one of which sounds really rosy and fantastic, and another one is so horrible that you can't even contemplate whether or not it was true,
that's the one that's true!
And unfortunately, that is the way I make my decisions. So I apologise if I appear, shall we say, a little bit hyped about it. Because I like to live my life with this thing called
a purpose!
Because if you don't have one, what the hell are you here for? And my very special guest is Charles Smith, broadcasting from behind a paper screen. Charles, welcome.
Okay, very, I loved your intro and I'm very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me on your show.
Well, you know, it is the most fun 2 hours in talk radio and I am the best interviewer in the world, so welcome. I'm pretty sure this is going to be great. So would you be able to tell us a little bit about yourself and what it is you do?
What do I do? I suppose we could say that I disrupt the dominant paradigm as much as possible in my own little way, in my own little corner of the blogosphere. And I don't really know why I've accumulated a readership, but I think, based on reader feedback, that a lot of us feel lonely, that we don't fit in. We know this is BS. It doesn't make sense. We don't feel what we're supposed to be feeling if everything was really as good as we're being told. And so people find any kind of outburst of honesty refreshing and they start feeling like a sense of community, you know, because it is lonely if you don't fit in the mainstream, right? And listening to your intro, I was reminded that Daniel Ellsberg, who went out on a limb and released the Pentagon Papers, back in the 70s that revealed a lot of the dirty secrets of the Vietnam War. He said, thousands of people knew about that. Thousands of people had access to the same thing. None of them released it. Only he did. And so that's a loneliness that I hope I never have to deal with. But anyways, that's I think what I do. And I tend to focus on finance and housing and systems because I think the solution is ultimately to band together in communities that are outside the mainstream but are self-supporting.
What kind of communities are we talking about? Physical communities, digital communities, currencies, etc.?
Yeah, both. I think the digital currencies and digital communities. They don't replace, you know, real world human communities, but they can help bootstrap human communities that have been, I guess you could say that the whole idea of human community has been disrupted or destabilized by these larger systems of central states, central banks, central currencies. All of those things have undermined human communities, right? Because if you need money, well, you work for a major corporation or you work for the government. And if you try to go outside those things, it's really hard to make a living. So, you know, they're like the Borg, right? And so it's they've undermined community for decades. And so to say, well, the solution is community, we need a digital community and a digital currency because it has to be outside the control of these major centralized central planning systems that dominate our lives.
Mm. This reminds me somewhat of sort of like the resistance to Agenda 21. Have you noticed that there kind of isn't one? Like it's got all these strata that's attacking every sort of fabric and weaving of society that simultaneously wants to get the state to run your life at the same time as it destroys and abandons national sovereignty. Now, isn't that a very, very big irony there?
Yes. And we, before we went on the air, we were discussing the multitude of ironies that characterize, you know, the system we live in.
Let's think about the characteristic of these ironies is what's humor. Shakespeare said something along the lines of a tragedy is merely a joke misunderstood. All right. And have you ever heard that phrase, oh, you'll look back at this and laugh? You ever heard that phrase? When you stumble and fall and hurt yourself really badly or your life gets destroyed or something like that, and some dick always says that to you? I can't fathom the reason why people do this, because, look, life is basically a really, really nice-tasting puddle of shit, right? And the problem is that the people who were actually contributing to that puddle of shit that we live in are the biggest assholes ever, right? And they're always up the top, shitting on us, and we're calling it rain. The whole concept of making a joke out of this really terrible reality, I think, is one of the most important things that stops people feeling alone and going crazy once they discover the pool of shit that they're actually living in.
Yeah, and I think, Vinny, I think you make an excellent point. And we know that some of the most mordant, cutting, true humor emerged in the former Soviet Union. You know, that was a survival technique. The more repressive the regime, then the more we turn to humor to remind us of our humanity.
Mm. Now, there is this concept as well of contributionism. Okay, so let's say the humanity as a whole. Let's say the alternative media as a whole. And I contribute to it, you contribute to it. Now, nobody told us to contribute, did they? Right? Nobody's forcing us to contribute, are they? We merely are. And I believe that in so doing, because we're following what's our calling, that's what actually makes an impact. That's actually what changes things is when people... You said that one guy who released that paper, Ryan, out of all of the other person. I explained to somebody the other day that the course of history is the story of one man or woman going up against the entire world. And the entire world eventually relenting because they were right and they wouldn't give up.
That's true. And I think there's several examples in recent history. The fellow that busted Big Tobacco here in the States was a similar case where, you know, there were thousands of people that knew that it was all a lie, that smoking was, you know, healthy for you or whatever. And so he secreted the documents out and took some risks, and you know he broke the back of one of the big lies, and of course there's a multitude of other big lies.
He broke. Are you saying he broke the back of Big Tobacco?
Yeah. Well, unless he say he broke a bone in. Yeah, maybe the narrative, you know, the advertising narrative got damaged.
Well,
maybe
I haven't. When was the last time you saw a cigarette commercial on TV?
Yeah.
All right. I haven't seen one since I was like a really, really young boy.
Right.
See, it actually worked, didn't it? As soon as you can change the narrative, everybody jumps ship and gets onto it. Like, I think Thomas Jefferson said something about patriots as well, as that patriots are the ones who are there, who are getting spit on by everybody else until such a time as everybody just realizes he's right, and then they suddenly become patriots themselves.
Yeah, and you know, Vinny, I want to go back to something you mentioned, which I think is really fundamental, and it's why I can't claim to be completely doom and gloom, although I write a lot about doom and gloom because we have to, right? is like what I call YouTube University. As you were talking about the ability to contribute to the world without any payment or guaranteed return on your gift. Look at how many amazing videos of instruction that are on YouTube. People just go on and they share their expertise and you know, how to use an iPod or how to fix a toilet. I mean, I myself turn first to YouTube as soon as I have some problem with technology or the real world, and I do have to interact with the real world, so plumbing problems and stuff like that. It's amazing. People are doing this. They want to contribute. And that's the narrative that's been completely lost in the sort of Keynesian cargo cult that we live in which we're all supposed to be rational economic animals who only respond to greed and fear. And actually, those are part of human emotions, but they don't define everything that we are. You know, they are a relatively modest part of who we are. And that we want to belong, we want to contribute, we want to have purpose and meaning, and giving and contributing is the best way to have goals, purpose, and meaning.
Rational, reasonable, and logical. We were at the David Icke conference just recently, and he goes, I wonder what rational means. He looks it up, and it says, well, it's being logical. And he looks like, what does logical mean? Oh, it says it's being reasonable. And he looks at, what does reasonable mean? Oh, it means being rational. Right?
Right.
Okay, and, you know, this spoke to me like volumes about how we see the world and how we're told that it is. Because if everything's just a reference to itself, it's like the dream construct in Inception, isn't it? If you can make somebody think in a circle that is perfect and reinforces itself and doesn't actually get any object in its way, you can make people live a perpetual life where they literally wind themselves into non-existence. And that's what people are doing now. We've gotten all this new footage from my mate Mike has gone out and shot a lot of the green screen backgrounds, right? And we've got lots of traffic and things like that. And I said to him, Mike, I want to see what these slaves are up to, mate. Get up there during rush hour on a bridge or something like that and just film these slaves in traffic. And it's just awful, mate. One time we were driving south to go to a funeral, and it was 20 to 5 in the morning, and people had already driven an hour from from down south further to come to Auckland to go to work, and they were already stuck in traffic halfway, right?
Yeah.
Talking about being stuck in traffic, getting up at 4 o'clock in the morning to get stuck in traffic for 3 hours on the way to work. And that just broke my heart. Like, just think about the immense amount of effort that has been, shall we say, exerted to break the human spirit, to make us so tired and so exhausted that when we come home, we can't think, let alone create anything.
So true. And I honestly thought those kinds of horrendous wastes of energy and time were unique to California. I didn't know that that was part of the New Zealand lifestyle as well.
Here's the problem with America. And it's also the same reason why I'm a really good talk radio show host from New Zealand in America. Because the same problems that you have are the same everywhere else. You got fluoride, you got chemtrails, you got traffic, you got Wi-Fi everywhere, you got a corrupt, tyrannical government, you got a brutal police force, you got a whole bunch of private contracting scum that are taking over your city council, you got lobbyists, don't you? You know, you're singing my song. It might as well be our fucking national anthem.
Well, you know, Vinny, you've probably covered this on many other shows, but how did you enter the alternative media? Because, I mean, of course, I'm personally curious, but I think I ask for a larger reason, which is people often or occasionally at least ask me, well, how do you break out of this? How do you make a living? How do you survive financially if you don't work for a major corporation or the government?
If you don't have a choice. All right.
I think that's an excellent answer.
It's as simple as that. I went to job interviews and I started started to have panic attacks, right? And it was just like, dude, Frank. After I got busted for selling weed, I no longer trusted, you know, authorities. I mean, because that was like just the last straw, you know. I'm pretty smart, unlike a lot of people, so it only took me maybe 600 or 700 betrayals by figures in authority before I started to figure out that you couldn't really trust any of them, you know. So the kind of thing that really forced me into it was the fact that I was working and I was making really, really good money, but at the same time I was coming home and I was watching like 2 documentaries a day on YouTube and listening to repeats of like talk radio from Truthers in the States and stuff like that. And I started to go crazy, right? It's when you have an awakening meltdown, right? Now, if you are having an awakening meltdown, you yell and scream at people who are close to you and love you because they're just talking about normal things that everybody thinks is normal, but you know to be a lie, right?
Yeah, right.
You get really emotional about it and you start to drive yourself inwards and you start to drive everybody away from you because you're going through an enormous change and you essentially form this kind of hard chrysalis around yourself. And because of that, because you're spending so much time alone, absorbing all this information which you haven't been put into practice, the brain has trouble adjusting what it knows from YouTube with what it's doing in the real world. And I was starting to go absolutely crazy. And so one day I called up my mate John Eisen, who runs Uncensored Magazine here in New Zealand. And I said to him, John, I just feel like quitting my job. He goes, does it feel right? And I go, yeah. And it did. Right. And all of a sudden, every single thing that I needed came to me. $20,000 worth of vouchers for a shopping center came to me so I could buy a computer and a camera and a tripod and various other things and live off that for a little bit. And then when I got really depressed that I went out to money, I went to the doctor and said, doctor, I'm really depressed and I need a sickness benefit. And he gave me some money and my depression went away. And so I basically spent a year drawing a benefit from the government for my depression because I was depressed because the government traumatized me for busting me, making videos and going to protests and things of that nature about how the government's corrupt on their dime. I consider it a public service, you know. Had to do me bit. Couldn't just sit around and smoke weed or anything. You have to go to the protests and do that. The cannabis protest, for example, that's how I kind of cut my teeth into it. But, yeah, in terms of this activism thing getting on this radio show, because of doing all those videos, I got noticed by Mitch Santel, who's one of the executive producer over at BigReggaeMix.com, I think. And he mentored me, taught me a lot of things. A lot of people have mentored me and taught me a lot of things, in fact. A lot of people have taken me under their wing, so to speak. But I'm rambling, and I'm sorry.
Oh, not at all. I because I think what interests me, and I'm sure it interests everybody in the alternative media space, or at least many of us, is, you know, we're each individuals with a history and a family and friends and so on. And so there's something, we're embedded in the real world, right? And but we also deal with abstract ideas and abstract systems that impact us in the real world. And in my particular case, I know that people probably wonder when they look at my blog and they see a bunch of stuff about finance or housing or political systems or whatever. And then suddenly there's a guy talking about gardening and food, right? Or, you know, exercise or fitness or whatever. But for me, I have to, the only anti-crazy narrative that I have is the real world. In other words, go out there in your garden and you know, grow food and enjoy harvesting your little crop of whatever you can grow on however much land you have, or a few plots on your concrete deck or whatever. And you get out there and you get away from the digital world and you go for a run or a bike ride or something like that. And you enjoy your time with your friends, and there's no TV on, there's no cell phones ringing. There's you're in the real world with people that you can relate to, and all of these things are incredibly nurturing. And so that's why I combine all that stuff that seems unrelated to politics and finance, because that's the only anti-crazy narrative we really have, is our own personal community of friends, and what you're growing in the dirt, and what you do in the real world.
Mm. People lose touch of that, and then they start to go crazy, kind of thing. And I see this crazy truth, as I call them. You know, I thought long and hard about what to call them. So the finally, I came to what I thought was an apt description, but they have a fixation. Okay, for me, it's sort of like the structure of the hologram, right? Truth is, because a hologram has all the information of the whole stored in any small part, right? And vice versa. And I think that they don't know this. So they'll have a look at something, let's say, the Vatican assassins or some other kind of scumbaggery organization, the Council on Foreign Relations or the Trilateral Commission, and look at them in and of themselves rather than seeing the big picture and realizing that these things are merely symptoms of a larger problem. They are reflections of a grander design. And through their overspecialization, they become zealous and aggressive and disrespectful, essentially. This is the thing that I'm starting to get really into now, is this mentality of, if this person is making money off the truth movement, if they're busting their ass 24/7 and aren't starving to death instead of just, you know, I don't understand the mentality quite yet. I'm working on it. But they want to be abusive. They want to attack people for things that they don't understand and probably didn't listen to. I'm not sure if you kind of get this, where I'm going with this, because I sure as fuck don't, and I don't know where they're coming from either.
Well, I think I relate to what you're saying in the context of, we live in a system that generates pathologies, right? That it's really not the way that humans were designed to live. And so the pathologies have all sorts of manifestations, like drug addiction that is not really positive. I mean, I'm all for weed. I don't think it's I don't think it's addictive like alcohol. And I drink alcohol and I enjoy it, but you know, it's a terrible drug, really. It kills, you know, millions of people or destroys millions of lives. And so
the World Health Organization actually did a study on that and said that alcohol is the most societally damaging drug. And when they talk about societal damage, they say you take the drug and then you go and you do something to somebody else, and then that somebody else has not the something, and then there's a knock-on effect from that. That's what they talk about when they say societal damage, is the actual damage that the drug itself actually does have a causality for in a wider sense. And the cannabis had virtually zero damage to society by comparison.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And I, a couple of years ago, I did research trying to find even one traffic fatality that could be linked to cannabis use, or as we say here, you know, 420. There's none, even from people who are, you know, seeking this kind of information to heap disrepute on cannabis. There's no evidence of even one traffic fatality. Meanwhile, I think it's something like 25,000 people are killed every year in the U.S. alone by drunks. And so, do you need any other evidence of which one is destructive to society and which one is a health benefit?
Well, that reminds me of another very interesting study that was conducted on, I think it was on Los Angelino drivers. And instead of looking at just like, were they drunk or were they stoned or were they this or that or the other, they had to look at all the risk factors. Now, risk factors for driving, they found out what they all are. Are you on psychotropic medications? Bing! Are you a young man? Bing! Are you sleep deprived? Bing! Are you angry? Bing! Are you in a rush? Bing! Cannabis users, are you angry?
No.
Are you in a particular rush?
No.
Are you sleep deprived?
Well, not particularly energetic, but no, not really. If I was sleep deprived, I'd probably be in bed.
You know, it just takes down the thing. And it gets down to this point where they found out that if you have a look at all the causality factors of it and you weigh them all up, let's say a young man who was drunk and stoned did the accident. It wasn't the cannabis that caused the accident. It was because he was a young man and because he was drunk. Right. And they found that the cannabis was a balancer, that there was actually a 30% decrease in the risk of having a traffic accident or fatality if there was cannabis in the driver's bloodstream. So it's actually safer to drive when you're high, right? Because you're only driving 5 miles an hour.
That's right. No, and I think what you've hit upon too, what I consider critically important points. One is how all these pathologies feed in on each other. That, you know, you're sitting in traffic, you're exhausted, you're sleep deprived, you're under financial strain if you're one of the 80%, and or maybe 95%, or maybe 99%. And all of these things weigh on your, erode your humanity and your ability to function. And so all those pathologies add up, you know. And the other thing I want to say, though, is I feel there is cause for hope. And, you know, hope is often overlooked, right, in the doom and gloom kind of blogosphere. But, you know, the general trend, and I don't know if this is true in New Zealand, but you can let me know. But the whole cultural shift around cannabis has moved away from believing the narrative that smoking a joint leads directly and instantly to shooting heroin, or this kind of insane narrative that was pushed on the public for like decades, right? It's like people just don't believe that anymore. And so now there's a proposition on the ballot here in California that legalizes recreational cannabis. Now, that's a step beyond medical. And of course, the federal government here is, of course, against everything. It's still a Schedule I drug equivalent to heroin and cocaine. But people no longer believe that's valid. You know, the narrative has shifted despite the enormous efforts made to criminalize cannabis. So there is hope, I think, and that's a good example of it.
Well, I like to give analogies about situations. I'm pretty anal about my analogies.
and my analysis. And humanity is like a spring. And I was explaining this to Cliff High one time, like a mechanical spring. You hold it down, and even when you, once you're holding it down, you've actually got to keep the pressure on it. Otherwise, it just poof, pops up. And eventually you get tired after a while, and you say, no. Humanity is not a machine. We're organic, okay? So think of an organic example, like a water spring. What happens when you try to push the water down, back through the rock? The water starts to burrow into the sides and carve out all new passages, and then starts to create new springs and spurts out in places you would never predict. That's what it's like trying to hold humanity down, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, and I appreciate your love of analogy or reliance on analogy, because that's how we actually understand stuff, is metaphor and analogy. And the spring is a wonderful example. And perhaps you can, I would be very interested in what analogy you would use to describe the potential of cryptocurrencies. And the reason why I ask you this is, you know, cryptocurrency is a very interesting thing because it's one of the few potentially useful technologies that can't really be centralized or controlled by central planners. And of course, I'm of the opinion that centralization is one of the core evils. In other words, once humanity allowed itself to be controlled by centralized anything, then it was already in deep trouble. So if you've got a form of money that can't be controlled by central planners, well, that's a step in the right direction, I think, because then there's lots of other things that we can start paying for that can't be controlled by central planners. So is there an analogy that fits that?
Yeah. It's
that's about, not a rhetorical question. I really would like the answer.
It's about ripping off a magician's trick, all right? The magician keeps his trick real secret. He's the only one who could do it, and he's got all the power and all the stage and all the ticket sales in the whole industry because he could do this trick and no other cunt can. And then somebody spills it that it's actually just a really simple sleight of hand and misdirection, and then starts doing a cheap copy of his own trick, which is just as good and just as entertaining and just as useful, and completely undermines the other magician, who starts going, "This is my intellectual property. You can't be doing that. It's really dangerous. You know, it's a very specialized technique that could be really bad for people if you do it wrongly, you know." How many people have died in your trick again? Thousands, but that's not the point. That's not the point.
That's an excellent analogy, and I think that we're talking about, like, the metaphor, the analogy of a spring undermining, you know, the dominant paradigm, if you will, or narrative. And I think that cryptocurrencies have great potential to do that once people really understand it. And I myself came to it late. I mean, people told me about Bitcoin back when it was like $12 or whatever. And it was like, well, this is interesting, but it seems hard to figure out how to actually buy it or whatever, or use it. So I'm too lazy. And now, of course, years later, it's becoming a lot easier, and I use it to pay people in other countries. And it seems to me that cryptocurrencies is a good model for how we could have an entirely different economy outside of whatever you want to call it. I call it state cartel capitalism, because it's basically a system of the state and cartels or monopolies. And then we're the debt serfs who need to work to pay our debts to those states and cartels.
Essentially.
So if we could create an economy that's opt-in, like, you know, in other words, it's not forced on anybody. If you want to join this economy, then fine. If you don't, fine.
I was thinking about an opt-in everything, right? I think what's happened at the moment is, because there's a structure to society, there's this quote-unquote establishment, which technically in the definition, if it's an establishment, then it's already been established and it's not in a state of emergent change, which it's not, so it's technically not an establishment. It's I would describe it as a passing thing, you know?
all bureaucracies and all forms of government eventually change over time, and the same people don't keep working there unless they're Henry Kissinger. I don't know how the fuck he's still alive, but evil. It does keep you alive. It doesn't make you look pretty, but it does keep you alive. Where was I going with this? No.
Opt-in.
Ah, yes. Opt-in on everything. Thinking about the political elections, right? And it's like, look, these politicians, Congress got like a 4% approval rating, right? And this is the lowest anticipated presidential race in U.S. history, with the lowest polling candidates that has ever been in the nation's history, right? Now, right. Let's say, if you just take the simple option and go, why do we need these people that we really hate? Okay, let's think about this rationally and logically and reasonably, which all mean exactly the same thing. Okay, we don't need them anymore. Have you ever been to a Facebook web page and then some abusive troll or something comes out when there's clearly defined guidelines and everything, and then somebody just quickly reports that person to the admin, and then the admin removes the comment and then blocks the person because they're that's how it can work. This is how we can do legislation. Hey, everybody, we've got this really great idea called Agenda 21 to globally enslave everybody. Let's vote on it and let's debate it and everything like that. And everybody goes, no. Okay, it's voted out. You know, that would be great if you had an email from the government, which you participate in as part of just your everyday life, as part of everybody's everyday life. They're actually participating in the political process, reading a little document here, voting on a little poll over here or something like that. And if we had that kind of very direct, hands-on legislation and government with all the people participating, you would eliminate the need for the political class entirely.
Yes. And, you know, Vinny, I think the technology exists now, as you referred to, like Facebook as one manifestation. The technology exists to make this real. And that wasn't necessarily true 20 years ago. It was too expensive. But now processing power and memory are so bloody cheap and ubiquitous that although most people in the mainstream media refer to these this cheap technology as, well, it means we're going to have more convenience, which is another way of saying we're going to profit some, you know, global corporation more. You know, in other words, your refrigerator will sense that you're almost out of milk and order it for you at an exorbitant, you know, price from some other global corporation. And this is supposed to be, we're supposed to be thrilled with this kind of, in quotes, convenience.
It's real convenient to be a slave.
Yeah, the potential is just as you described. And, you know, there's stories coming out in the non-mainstream media where people are, you know, filling potholes in their town's streets by themselves. You know, they're not doing it because the government ordered it or organized it or anything. They're saying, well, there's a bloody pothole there. Let's just fill it. And they get together on the weekend and put up a few dollars each and buy the material and voila. Yeah. And it's all like, wait a minute. This is as revolutionary as, or perhaps more revolutionary than chopping the heads off a few elites and then replacing them with another elite, which is, you know, what history suggests revolutions often end up being. And so this is a broad-based revolution. And what we're really talking about is we can all be part of it.
Mm. Put up some big billboards. If you see something that needs doing, get off your frickin' lazy citizen ass and do it.
Yeah. And so what I, you know, I wrote this book and okay, I'm guilty of what do you call it when you talk up your own work? I don't know. I can't think of
tooting your own trumpet, blowing your own horn.
That's right.
Chafing your own carrot. Oh, wait, that's a different reference. Go again.
So anyways, it's called A Radically Beneficial World. And what I describe in the book is a system that takes these ideas we're talking about and integrates them. So it's the system I propose is called the community labor integrated money economy, because it integrates the community, the work we do, and then we get paid for it with a currency that we control. And to me, this seems like a really obvious idea. But I realize it's really outside the mainstream. And so people are like, huh, wait a minute. What do you mean? You know, like, it's very alien. And yet it's like, well, why is it alien that we would have an economy that we would control, that would have a global currency? So if I wanted to buy a generator from somebody in New Zealand, I could do so more or less through, like I do, through eBay or something. And I would pay with the money that I earned in my own community. But the money was not dollars or yuan or euros. It was a currency that's created by the communities in this economy. And it seems obvious to me, but I guess it's not obvious. And so talk about your, you know, when we're talking about the system or the establishment, what we're really talking about is we're told some things are so obvious they must be true. But actually, they're not obvious. Actually, the other stuff is obvious, but it's so hidden behind all these pathologies that we don't really get to see what's obvious.
Mm. Somebody once said that the obvious is what nobody can put into words except a genius.
Well, I don't claim that mantle, but it's certainly true that if once we describe a new system, then it opens a lot of people's minds, because if it's undefined, we can't all create a system. But if we read about a system that seems to be make sense, then we can add to it. You know, we can contribute to that.
Yeah. Well, it's like somebody telling you a very, very simple story that uses a lot of the words maybe and kind of and sort of, when there isn't actually really anything going on in the story, and you just sort of get there and you're sort of bored because there's no real point to it. And this is where most people find themselves in their life, like, but they haven't come to that realization yet. They haven't realized that, oh my God, there's actually no point to my life right at this moment. I'm not living my life. I went to school because mum and dad told me to. I got the job because the school told me it was a good idea. And I keep in the job because my boss told me I'll get a better job afterwards. And it's this constant little carrot in front of me that I've been chasing my entire life. And the entire time, I should have actually been dancing to my own tune instead of waiting for somebody else to play the music for me.
Absolutely. And the power of these narratives is immense, because we're told them endlessly through media, right? In other words, and one of the things I write a lot about is the whole pathology of growth and consumerism, because a lot of what we're told is you define yourself by what you wear and what you own and what brands you're attached to and what you display on your body. And once you go down that pathway, then you're already very deep in a really disturbing pathology. And yet this is the pathology that we're told the whole economy lives on. If we don't have growth and we don't have consumerism, we're all going to die. And it's all like, well, actually what's going to die is a completely destructive, unsustainable, pathological system. That's what's going to die.
What I like. The economy is like the Hunchback of Notre Dame. At a certain point, there's an amount of growth that's not fucking healthy.
Yeah, I mean, what's the thing that grows eternally? Well, it's actually called cancer, and it kills you. That's the metaphor I would use for our economy. Is we're told that cancer is terrific because it's always growing, and you can't stop it, and it's always expanding. Yeah, but it kills the host.
Well, I don't know. That'd be quite interesting if, like, people do like a cancer report and to say how the cancer's doing and how many jobs the cancer's going to create this year. at the end of the cancer year, is there a greater folding in? Is there a lot more stock coming in? Is there a lot more profitability of it? I mean, it could, look, at this point, cancer is literally propping up the economy in some sense. Like I'm actually kidding. There was some article that came out that said some doctor had prescribed something like 80 patients of his over a number of years cancer treatments for cancer that he knew that they didn't have, because the rounds of chemo that they would purchase, he got a commission on. Right? Can you imagine going through chemotherapy, having your hair fall out, having your entire family think that you're going to die because a doctor wanted to make a few extra fucking bucks off you? That is a cancerous growth on society. Now, isn't it interesting how cancer spreads like that?
Yeah. No, and that's an analogy that fits the healthcare system in the U.S. Of course, as we all know, if you set out to design a sick, pathological, destructive system, you'd come up with the U.S. healthcare system, along with all the other cartels. So how do we evade this? How do we make sure that we don't have to be part of this? And it's actually quite a challenge, because we're inundated with ads and adverts that tell us, you know, that what we buy defines who we are. Mm-hmm. And so to me, the first step of freeing ourselves is to start defining ourselves by other things, such as how many good friends do we have? In other words, how many friends do we have that we really listen to and that we can count on ourselves? How many sources of income do we have that are outside, you know, the corporate cartel structure? And how do we feel about ourselves in terms of our purpose and our goals and our meaning of our life? And like you said, if we start asking ourselves these and defining who we are by these things, then suddenly it's like, well, I really don't care anymore what brand of, you know, trousers I'm wearing or whatever. And I don't really care what kind of car I drive. If I have to have a car, then let it be durable and something I can work on myself. And you know that. So that kind of change, though, is so far outside the mainstream that most people, they may give lip service to it, but they have very difficult time escaping from that black hole.
It's a non-distinct inevitability. I mean, it's inevitable, but it might not happen for them. Kind of like the grief process. Like, you're guaranteed to go through the denial stage, guaranteed to get angry, guaranteed to bargain and get depressed, but you ain't guaranteed to pass through the acceptance stage, are you? All right, you might be depressed the rest of your entire life. And that's what these people are going through. They might be stuck in the denial stage for a bit. And so the way you approach it is you use the information grenade, which is a non-emotional attachment information. Shh, boom, just throw it in and hopefully it blows up in their face later. And statistically speaking, I call it the seventh man. If the first person comes up to you and said that, did you know that chemotherapy doesn't cure cancer and that there are many, many cancer cures, and they say that you're a crazy conspiracy theorist, get out of my doctor's office, you schmuck. Right. And another person comes in, says the exact same thing, and he says the same thing. But by the time the seventh person at some point in their life comes up to them and says the exact same thing that's completely outside of their belief structure, but it's true nonetheless, then they'll start to consider abandoning that belief structure and everything that goes with it. That's when the grief structure really starts to take hold. And in order to go from that sheep existence where we've been conditioned into the... Okay, it's money and pussy, essentially. For a guy, that is your quest in life, all right? Hey, look at this guy over here. He's got money and pussy. And for girls, I don't know what it was. It was to be beautiful and to have success at their work, right? And again, which is money and pussy, except they are the pussy. Right? And that's what it was. So if you can get people completely attached into this sexual frame of mind where there's no actual attachment, there's no bonding that's happening during the sexual experience, there's no real relationships happening there if it's mostly flirtatious, their ability to exist with another person and to have a balanced relationship, anything that really lasts, anything that has a fabric, anything that has a solid bedrock gets slowly eroded away. And
with the money, because it's so superficial, but because there are so many things you can do with it, that is one of the best distractions ever devised for a reason to live your life. Why are you living? Well, to make money. Really? You ever thought about what money really is? Well, no, because I've been preoccupied with what I can do with it and how much of it I've got. Okay. What if I told you that if it was just a representation of energy that you could create out of thin air yourself online without the need for any work or any bank to do that for you, and you'd actually enjoy doing it and enjoy giving them the finger every time you go and purchase something with that money power instead of being a wage slave working your ass off every day at a job you hate for a scumbag who freaking just pisses you off with his stupidity and makes you wonder why you're not in charge of the company. And then you realize that it's because he's a psychopath and he sabotaged his competition because he was the least competent person for the job, so he just spread rumors around the office about the other people.
Exactly. Or that the people around that psychopath thought, how do we ditch this person? How do we get rid of them? And the answer is, oh, kick them upstairs, promote them. And that works. They're out of my little corner of the corporation or government, but now they even have more power. And now they have more power to disrupt and destroy other people's lives. So, and yeah, there's so many perverse incentives. And I admit that that's one of my favorite phrases, perverse incentives, because the system has so many perverse incentives. And then it feeds on itself, like we're talking about, that the pathologies add up. It's not just one pathology. You end up accumulating ones that are self-reinforcing. But, you know, you've said some things that I think, of course, because you're the world's best alternative talk show host, and I totally agree, that you've said some things that we should explore a little farther.
We do in the second hour, so you're going to have to hold tight for that one. But let's just quickly jot them down so we don't freaking forget.
Well, you mentioned like sexual politics, and that's a phrase from the 60s, and that shows how old I am that I remember that phrase. But you're so right that the age of like hookups and that kind of, as you say, flirtation, it's another erosion of humanity that is passed off as some sort of freedom. And of course, we're talking about ironies. And of course, there's multiple ironies there, that what we're sold as freedom to consume as you want, you know, is actually a form of imprisonment.
Yeah.
And the sexual politics of the current era is imprisoning to a lot of people. It's not freeing. And yet it's of a piece with consumerism and the rest of the pathologies.
And we'll get more into the sexual politics after the break, ladies and gentlemen, with Hillary Clinton's vagina. My very special guest is Charles Smith, who, unlike Hillary Clinton, didn't help a vile, beating, raping pedophile get off in 1975. In the legal sense of the word. He did, well, maybe in the other sense of the word too. We don't know. Anyway, go to thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and donate today, ladies and gentlemen. $1.50 a week into that Kiwi Bank account. If you're a New Zealand listener, maybe $2 a week into that PayPal. They really, really help, those little regular donations. We'll see you after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com and American Freedom Radio. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio, The Vinnie Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Just because we're being exterminated doesn't mean we can't make it fun. Otherwise, what's the point in getting killed? My very special guest is Charles Smith. Welcome back.
Thank you, Vinnie. That first hour went by so fast.
I know. I'm like a line of coke that way. Now, we were talking about sexual politics here, and the concept of this, what's the word I'm looking for? The age of the feminazi, right? We're coming into that age. My wife was telling me today, I think that Hillary's going to become the president. And I go, what do you think that? Well, just because he had a first black president, then a first woman president, kind of seems like the logical move, right? And I'm starting to think, you know, maybe she's right. And maybe that might be the kick in the pants the humanity needs to just go, you know what? If it goes Bush, Clinton, Obama, or something, blah, 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 you just need to realize that they're all related by first cousin, at least. And then all of a sudden, the facade drops away. Oh, wait. I pronounced it wrong. It's called facade.
You know, let's go back to, if you don't mind, to one of the things you said in the first hour, where you were talking about the moment, or perhaps in your introduction, in the moment of awakening. Like, what causes us to start becoming curious or to realize that the facade is false?
Betrayal and trauma and no. The word is disillusionment. If you look up the definition, it's when something becomes a lot less good than it initially or once was thought to be. All right? Disillusionment, the removal of the illusion. One of my mates was telling one of his friends about 9/11 was an inside job. And he goes, oh, you just believe in that conspiracy theory because you're disillusioned. Exactly, mate. Exactly. I'm no longer operating under a delusion as you were.
Right. And so I think we can sort of generalize perhaps that a lot of people have a moment of awakening when they realize, as you said earlier, that their life has no purpose and meaning, that working for money to support their consumption is actually a very empty life. And a lot of people reach this point in their middle age when they have squandered their early years making money and acquiring all the things that they were told would make them happy, and then they realize they're not happy. That's one avenue. The other one is sort of the we were talking about when the conspiracy that's mocked and derided in the mainstream is suddenly proven to be correct by an insider revealing all that to be true. That's a moment of awakening. Another moment of awakening is when you're gung-ho and you join the XYZ, whatever it is. It could be the military, it could be corporate, global corporation, and you're going to do wonderful things, and then you realize you were just used up and thrown away. That's a moment. Another one is art, and especially, I think, the visual arts. And so I wanted to bring that up because, you know, part of the pathology of the mainstream is to deride art and intellectuals and to make fun of anything that requires any thought or any insight or any sensitivity. And so, I wanted to mention, I just saw some of the early films of Michelangelo Antonioni in the early 60s. And these are films that are slow. I mean, by modern standards, a lot of people probably want to fall asleep. Like, it's boring. But what he's really talking about is the impossibility of having a decent relationship between a man and a woman in the current society. And if you understand that as the context, then maybe the films become enlightening. And to me, they were a revelation. We shouldn't overlook the idea that art, and it can be like a movie or it could be a documentary. And I think of Adam Curtis as a documentarian that has produced a lot of, you know, stuff that if you really watch it and think about it, that it can open a lot of minds. There's a lot of visual stuff as well as books and other kinds of art that can break through that illusion of normalcy or whatever you want to call it. And I don't know whether you've had that kind of experience or other people have described that to you.
Well, I think it may be a causal factors. Let's say
you got a couple of mates that talk to you about conspiratorial things. You got a an old friend or a mentor or something like that that talked about it too. And you kind of get betrayed by a lot of authorities all the time, and you kind of never really fit in. And you hear some interesting stuff on occasion, but you don't really change anything. And the only time it really changes or clicks for you is when you get traumatized, essentially. You'll come to a realization at the point of trauma, and you'd been waiting a long time to have that realization. However long you'd been waiting, that's how significant the trauma that will be inflicted upon you must be in order to snap you out of it. If you want to talk about enlightenment, I think because of the fact that we are subjected to a form of trauma-based mind control for a large percentage of our life, in some cases from birth, and trauma-based mind control is things like sleep deprivation or being ostracized or collectively punished and things of this nature. Essentially, it's schooling and childcare and your jobs, etc. They're all forms of trauma-based mind control. And when you watch television or in most forms of recreation, even sport, for example, there's the same trauma-based mind control sort of things that are there as well. If you're a terrible player, you get abused, etc. by everybody else, and you get looked down on, and it's all a big group of everybody who looks up to the captain and or obeys the coach, etc. So we're all basically programmed the whole time to be these marionette puppets that are literally dancing our way through life to somebody else's tune. At some point, your strings get cut and the music stops and you're all alone and you're really, really sad because everything that you once valued and all the joy that was once there for you is no longer there. The music has stopped. The stage lights are out and your strings are cut and you can't move and you're limp. That's the moment when you start to reevaluate who you really are and what this image of yourself that they've been trying to program you with really was.
Yes, I think you've made an excellent description of it. And I would just add that we're all imbued with this sense of failure that we didn't somehow manage to be happy in this overlapping pathologies. And so that's also crushing as you go, well, wait a minute. Why aren't I happy? Why didn't I succeed in this system? And then you realize you can't because the system doesn't really enable happiness, you know, in the sense of self-fulfillment or self-realization. And so I think you're absolutely right. And I would just kind of add that one possibility for people to experience this kind of loss is bankruptcy. In other words, financial collapse is a very common way to experience this. You can experience it as a psychological breakdown, or you can experience it as a financial one, or
a medical one, a religious one.
Yes, exactly.
All right. A think about this. Psychopaths. Yeah. You talked about psychopaths and how they structured society. Max Egan once told me that if you wanted to understand the world, just understand that the world designed by a psychopath in order to fulfill a psychopathic objective, and then suddenly you'll understand why every institution does what it does and is the way it is, because it was created by and was run by psychopaths. Okay? World suddenly make a whole lot of sense to you? Oh, this world's so crazy, it doesn't make any sense. Well, what if you were a crazy psychopath? Would it make a lot more sense then? Well, yeah, everybody's slaves, I'm all powerful, I'm really rich, but this is great.
and, you know, the tragedy is it makes everybody in the institution crazy and pathological because, you know, the perverse incentives. I mean, if you want to survive in this system, then you have to do XYZ, and then XYZ destroys yourself.
Yeah. And eventually they make XYZ illegal, and then the street value on it goes up, and you get busted for selling it.
You know, I let me ask you for an analogy for the digital world, which is like all things in life has positives and negatives. And, you know, I write a lot of books, and I make I make money. I mean, I need some people to buy my books, even though I am aware of the fact that very few people are capable of reading an entire book anymore because they need to check their Facebook and Twitter, and they need to download some more stuff from Spotify, and and all that digital distraction is very appealing for a lot of different really deep reasons, but I think that the digital world also, I mean, we know about the potential for distraction, but it also provides us with potentially life-changing opportunities, like the YouTube University we're talking about, access to documentaries, access to communities, and other really smart, insightful people that we would never have been able to meet otherwise. And so there's this sort of yin-yang to the digital world that I'd love to hear your views on.
I don't cater to the people who don't have an attention span.
Something about your two-hour time span tells me that.
I mean, and, ironically, I've been uploading a few shorter videos to Facebook and YouTube a bit recently because there's these little bits in my shows where I'll explain something in a very simple way and then make a joke and then laugh my own ass off at my own joke afterwards, which I find really funny as well, even in the third person when I'm sitting there editing it, So I just put it in there and put a little ta-da on the end of it, which... I crack myself up, bro. I do. And this is the thing. You've got to be able to enjoy yourself in life. Okay, so the duality of the internet, it's like a prosthesis, okay? Whatever it is you have inside you, in your mind, is going to be amplified by the internet. Are you a douchebag? You're going to be a super douchebag. Are you an intelligent person who likes to learn? You're going to learn a super shitload, and you're going to become a radically different person who realizes that they weren't as intelligent as they thought they were, which ironically makes them even more intelligent than they were. Okay? And essentially, that's what it is. It's a double-edged sword. For everything that we love, we create something that we hate, and vice versa. Everything that we use to create, we also use to destroy. Some of the greatest conveniences in our modern day were created during wartime as a weapon. And what the internet is a weapon. It is pointed at all of us. Some of us have merely been able to point the weapon back at the people who created it.
I think that's very insightful. And I say that quite honestly, that I hadn't really thought about the internet as a weapon or the digital world as a weapon. And of course, the primary motive other than mind control is profit. And, I don't think there's anything wrong with profit. It's built into our human nature. If we find a tree loaded with fruit, well, we'll load up on that. The idea of windfalls is quite built into us.
But we always share that fruit with the tribe when we get back because we could never eat it all ourselves.
That's right. And we count on those people sharing what they find in a windfall. So That's kind of one of the core concepts that I've glommed onto, if you will, in my book, which is that's actually our core nature, is that we've survived, we've adapted, and we've prospered by contributing to a group. And there's a movement, and I forget the title of this, but there's a fellow who claimed or proposed that our natural maximum size of the human group is 150 people, because that's a typical sort of tribe or tribelet, if you will. And it's very difficult for us to move to become intimate or to communicate with a group larger than that. And actually, we prefer groups more like 15, and those 15 people might be 10 groups would then be part of a group of 150. But beyond that, we're wasting too much time negotiating and communicating and bonding and all that stuff. So it sort of suggests to me that the ideal social structure is opt-in groups of between 15 and 150, and those groups would decide what work was most useful in their community, and they would do that work. And whether it was profitable or not was a secondary consideration to whether it was useful in their group. And then they'd be paid with this decentralized currency, which is unlike Bitcoin. It's not mined. It's created for the sole use of these communities. And then they can use this currency to trade with other communities. And I don't see why that wouldn't work.
You need to make people care, right? And making people care about their community is probably one of the easier things to do because it's right there. They live in it kind of thing. However, if they're distracted from their community because they've got the internet instead of real interaction with their community, that becomes a bit of a problem, and you've got to actually build that community. How do you build it in the real world when everybody is stuck inside on their computers and doing this kind of thing? I don't know. It's the mechanics of it. I'm not 100% sure. But I think you could probably use the internet to contact them and say, hey, walk outside your front door, cunt. I'm out here with a shovel. We're supposed to be planting some lettuces on the grass verge here because this grass verge is just getting sprayed with chemicals and things of that nature. So we're going to dig up all of that poison soil, lay some new stuff, and turn it into a really beautiful organic vegetable garden. How about that, son? Right? Now, it takes initiative. As we were talking before in the first hour about how history is a series of one man telling everybody that they're wrong and then everybody eventually accepting him because he wouldn't give up and he actually was right. Okay? And if one person just takes the leap, another person sees him and follows him, etc., then that's what happens. A waterfall starts from a single drop of water, right? If you just do something, and it doesn't seem to matter what you do, I've found, if you believe in it and you put your effort into it and you do it just because you want to do it and because it's a reward in and of itself, that's what really changes the world and changes yourself.
Very well said, because we want to trust other people, but our entire system breeds distrust. And so trust has become like a scarce commodity, if you will. And so we're basically told constantly be on the outlook for BS because somebody's going to sell you something. And so the idea that someone would say, well, let's beautify our community and dig up that poisoned grass and replace it with something that adds some value to the community. It's like, well, wait a minute. What's your scam here? You know? And so we've been poisoned by the pursuit of political power and wealth, you know, because that's what we think is the only possible incentive. But actually, underneath that pathology, there are other sets of incentives that we want to contribute. And if you think about what makes people happy, I think we know from our own experience, we like doing stuff with our friends. And if it happens to be so-called work, like we accomplish something, that's just another expression of our friendship. You know, we don't have to just be sitting around drinking beer, although that's fine, or smoking weed. That's enjoyable for a while. But actually, we also prefer to get out there and do something and then congratulate each other. Hey, look at what we did.
While we were drinking and smoking weed.
Yeah, we'll do that on the break.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, accomplishing stuff is actually extremely gratifying and creates a lot of happiness. And yet that's been lost, you know, in these layers of pathology, that the only incentives that are recognized are greed, fear, and
it wasn't lost, though. It wasn't like, you know, it's like a set of car keys, you know. Oh, I just fucking lost my mojo, man. Systematically stamped out. How many older cultures existed pre-Columbus and pre-Spanish Inquisition and the cleansing of South America versus how many exist today? They got systematically exterminated because they used psychotropic drugs to unlock people's perceptions and see the world for what it really was, and the really psychopathic controlled church at the time really didn't like competition.
Yeah, and of course the same thing happened with LSD in the early 60s. It was legal until it became discovered, and then it was quickly criminalized.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, for the same reasons that you just described.
LSD trials. I found that was really funny. I saw this video one time. They tried to get soldiers on LSD to try and, like, follow commands and like, go through the trenches and do exercises and stuff like that. Good luck, buddy! They were rolling around to the trenches laughing their asses off because they suddenly realized that they weren't in a real fight and they were tripping balls. I mean, look, the concept of people fighting while high on drugs is not a new concept, okay? It goes back to ancient times, the hashishin, or the modern version of assassin, the word, was because they were high on hashish. Well, they were killing people, Bray. Now, let's think about this. The concept of a drug used in war versus a drug that is used in peacetime. Mind-expanding substances, magic mushrooms, and the peyote rituals and things like that. The teachings of Don Juan, etc. And Carlos, written by Carlos Castaneda. There was another guy who wanted to write the teachings of Don Juan, but never got around to it. He was Carlos Procrastinator, but but anyway, the concept of higher consciousness and actually achieving this, it was about, I don't know, fulfilling great purposes in life that were your own. So somebody else looking inward, looking at what you're doing in your life, what you've discovered is your actual purpose, would go, you know, that's really great and everything, but that's not really what I want to do, because it's so individual and unique to that person that nobody else, having knowing what it fully costs and the work that's actually required in being who you are and doing what you've done, only you and your own sequence of events has led you to that point. Only you can live that life. And I think that these rituals that got stamped out, these spirit quests and journeys through the mind, were eradicated specifically because long ago it was planned that humanity needed to be cut off from its higher consciousness. I think that our selfishness and shallowness that we see today is not a new phenomenon that is only just coming about because we've got the technology to distract us or anything. I think that systematically, in many different ways, this has been going on for many, many generations.
I think you've touched on something profound, and I say that as a student of philosophy. I will confess, and this puts me in the crosshairs, of course, that I earned a degree in philosophy and was deeply interested in Taoism and Buddhism as well as Marxism. And I think you've really described a lot of what the Taoist mindset focused on, which was, you know, if you want to buy into the political narrative of gaining power and trying to keep your power and establish wealth and all that kind of stuff, you're lost to yourself already, and that you're going to have to turn inward. That, of course, is really alien. And now they haven't been able to outlaw Taoism directly.
Well, I mean, it would destroy the Tao industrial adverts, that's for fucking sure, you know.
That's right. But so what we're really talking about here is, which I absolutely love, which is we're talking about self-realization or transcendence, and what kind of culture encourages that or enables that as opposed to stamps it out.
How can he create a society that allows people to find his or her destiny and pursue this, pursue happiness of their own way? Well, I think there was a country that was based upon this concept. Which one fucking was it? I can't really recall it. You know, I mean, it just reminds me of what George Carlin said. Hey, you know, we're invading Iraq now. Yeah, we're going to teach them about democracy. We'll loan them the Constitution. I mean, we don't appear to be using it.
Yeah, I have this. I put this thing out on my blog called the Smith Principle. And it was like, if you can't get rid of your leadership in an election, then you're a democracy in name only. Because if you can't, it's like, how do we get rid of Hillary Clinton? I mean, exactly what process is needed to get rid of Hillary Clinton and Bill and the Clinton Foundation and the whole mess? And it's like, well, there doesn't seem to be any process. We can't get rid of them.
Well, according to a former CIA assassin, the process, you need at least three guys at $250,000. All right. He'll do it. You know, he started up give a little account. People can donate to the Assassinate the Clintons and Bush Foundation. Ruthless assassins have already been approached, and they say, look, you front up with the money, we'll come up with the goods.
Sadly, I'm afraid it's, you know, one of the most damning things I ever read was when the Nazis took over France, that you would think they would kick out the French aristocracy and implant their own, you know, Nazi aristocracy. But in fact, the chateaus remained in the ownership of the French aristocracy, and then the German high command just became the visitors. And so that's, I think, you know, we like to think, or we're told, that these elites are at war with each other. But if we did, you know, if something did happen to send the Clintons to the, you know, happy hunting ground, there'd be somebody else to replace them instantly. And so what we really need to do is get rid of the entire system of concentrated power. Right?
It's this one structure and one structure only, and it's a form of structures that can be replicated. It's called hierarchy.
Right.
If there's anybody at the top, if it's not a round table, if it's a pyramid, it's a hierarchy, and you don't want it, okay?
Right.
Hierarchies need to be basically the whole concept of hierarchies. If it gets eliminated and destroyed and doesn't return, that'd be nice by me. If rules were actually made up of people actually conversing equally without authority telling them what to do or what to think, or training them all throughout their entire lives what to do, what to think, so that they can then become decision makers who've been told what to do and what to think, and it just keeps going round and round in a corkscrew fashion, and the only thing that gets screwed is you.
Yeah, and you know, I think you've touched on something absolutely essential, which is the pyramid structure of this system we live in. And however you define the pyramid, or whoever you define who's at the top, the structure itself is fatally flawed. In other words, as you say, once you have a hierarchy, then you've already destroyed everybody in the bottom 95%, right? Because they're just debt serfs, or they've been trained to do what the top, you know, 1 or 5% want. And so we want to talk about a system that eliminates hierarchy and doesn't allow it to exist. And I think such a thing is possible with, ironically, perhaps technology, software, digital currencies, you know, global sharing. I mean, these things become possible because of technology. And as you say, there's good and bad in the digital world. But I think that the potential for this kind of non-hierarchical organization is really there. And we're seeing it already in like YouTube University And even though we mock it, and it richly deserves to be mocked, things like Facebook and social media.
There are so many examples of why technology is actually the best way to get decision-making done in a quick and efficient fashion. From sports teams, for example, there was a English team, like just a local sports club, and they launched a website, and their fans were the only members of this website, and their fans got to pick and vote on what positions which players would play in and what players would sit on the bench, etc., or whatever. And they let the players decide via direct democracy how their team would be structured, who they'd play against, and so on and so forth. And they won the cup. Right? They went from the very bottom of the rank to winning because they let everybody in on the decision-making. Only the fans, only the very small amount of people in that local area who were really fanatical about that club and really loved it and were really willing to put in the time, who really went to the games, who actually participated. The digital interface through the people interacting when they're not physically together after the fact, that, I think, is the augmentation of the human spirit. If it augments something that is real, that is there, that you do in real life, and then exacerbates it and creates it and replicates it and keeps it going, that's fine. But if it's merely a control structure that tells everybody what to do and doesn't give anybody a chance to do what they want to do and doesn't give them a chance to have a say, then no. Just no.
Yeah, I think that the situation you described with the football team, that should be the basis of our entire economy, right? I mean, you know, we talk about, you know, central banking and all this quasi-complicated stuff, but actually that's an economy that would thrive because people would be expressing their enthusiasm and their knowledge, because you can bet the people that were involved in that group that voted, they knew every player's strengths and weaknesses, right? That otherwise they wouldn't have an opinion, or they'd be rejected by their peers. And so, you know, when we think about a sociopath trying to take control of a group of 15 people, and, you know, if you've been in community groups about that size and you know how that works, nobody's going to vote for them, or, you know, and they can't really force us to vote them in, especially not permanently. The group just dissolves. Like you can be a leader of yourself because the other 14 of us just left.
Yeah, that's quite funny, actually, because there's this dude named Pete Santilli. He stole the concept of my guerrilla media network off of me, right? Just after we had this big conference call on it, and I explained the whole structure and how it's supposed to work and everything for everybody. And then he goes and creates his own one. And I go, good luck with that, buddy, because I knew he was a psychopath and that only somebody with a whole lot of empathy and a whole lot of heart can really make a network full of people with diverse opinions, expressing them with equal value, could ever make something like that work. And sure enough, 14 months later, the rats abandon the sinking ship and create their own little one over here. See? And that's just how it works. And because I'm a narcissist, I'll just be honest with you for a second here. You know, you may have noticed that I love myself a lot. The personality traits, the charm of psychopaths are identical in value to the charms of a narcissist like me. That's why I feel like they're my natural enemy. Have you ever noticed you hate what you're most like because you know that you're this close to turning into it?
Right.
Yeah. It's like, I don't know. I feel like they're attracted to me, like, because I've still got creativity and empathy and compassion and connection to my higher self and all of that, and they don't. They've had it taken from them. They get attracted to me so much, and I get approached by them all the time, wanting my ideas, wanting my help and all of that kind of stuff, trying to suck my energy. I'm like this big glowing light, and they're just like this dark shadow that can't even get any closer because it's just... You can't get closer to the light when you're a shadow, motherfucker. All right? The light chases you away. It doesn't do, dumbass!
Well, I think, as I might have mentioned earlier, something about sincerity and honesty, I mean, you know, like the real thing, the legitimacy of sincerity and honesty is deeply attractive to people because they do feel so alone. They know that it's all just insincerity and bullshit, right? That's what they're sold. That's what they're told. And they crave some sense of honesty. And so when you are honest about yourself and what you see, and you and encourage your guests to be honest, it's like a breath of fresh air that just resonates very deeply in us, even if we disagree.
Honesty, because it's so freaking rare, it's like common sense, right? How it's just not that common anymore, and it's more like platinum sense, like this really rare element that you have to, you know, proceed through various dangerous mining and shuffling techniques in order to fucking find this common sense. Where is it? Oh, God. It's terrible, right? I think, what was it? Memory. Memory is structured so that the bad ones are always remain very clear and the good ones always fade, right? And the reason why this is because you are supposed to avoid having bad occurrences in your life, and you're supposed to always try and create new good experiences in your life, I believe. That's why all the bad things are sharp in your mind and all the good memories fade, because you're supposed to create new good ones every day.
Right, right. And the survival benefits of that are evident, right? Like if we have been chased by a shark and barely escaped, well, that just sticks in our minds. Like be careful when you're in the water, the open ocean. But and so there's a benefit to that. And I think but the survival benefit of having experiences with others that have profound meaning to us, that's what I think you're talking about. You know, both personal insight, like we get that aha moment that you said that very few people have. That's precious. That's very scarce. And so is really connecting with people. And that's such a sad statement that's a rarity now. That's a scarce commodity in this world.
No, I found that when people are really drunk and really high, that's when you can get them, all right? When I was doing videos for parties and things like that, going out into the dance clubs, I could get these people who weren't quite anywhere near the cusp of waking up to suddenly go like, whoa, because they were wasted enough and what I was telling them was cogent and short enough that it could penetrate their programming. Their firewall had come down so much, and it was so open to other things, as you are when you're drunk. Have you noticed that when you're drunk, that's when a lot of people try marijuana for the first time? It's the alcohol that's the gateway drug, essentially. Now, people might think this is a little bit dangerous, going and talking conspiracy theories and philosophy with drunks and stuff like that. I don't think so. You know? Oh! You know, there might be a little bit of element of risk. I'm not going to totally rule that out. But all I'm saying is some of the most profound conversations, I have no idea whether or not it actually truly affected these people. But some of these conversations where people have had with me when I'm really drunk or really wasted had truly profoundly affected me. I know that. And that's why I share that with other people. Now, this doesn't mean that it's the getting wasted that is the point. And this is the interesting thing. Get yourself into an altered state of consciousness where you're a lot more comfortable than you ordinarily would be. And then allow yourself to talk about things you wouldn't ordinarily be comfortable talking about, wouldn't ordinarily be open-minded enough to talk about. That was the entire point why I liked and enjoyed getting wasted and going and hanging out with people and talking about stuff. And surprise, surprise, all the people that I was getting wasted and hanging out with that weren't talking about very interesting things, I stopped hanging out with them. Right? You go through that filtering process. Good people, good sources of knowledge, good friends. These are nuggets of gold that you have to panhandle for years to even find. You have to sit with your pan
shivering through the dirt and shaking it around and around until all that filth and scum, piece by piece, gets out of that. And down at the bottom, there's that little bit of gold, that something of real, intrinsic value that is not a lie. And that aren't just there because you're giving them another line of coke.
Right, right. And I think what you're talking about is when we get a bit tipsy, we are more open to trusting the people around us, even though it may be, you know, the effect of the alcohol. But we're
suggestible, all right? That's the thing. Getting them in that mind control state sort of thing.
That's right. And the other thing occurs to me listening to you describe that state is, even if we're not wasted, if we come across a personality who is stripped bare and extremely sincere in a way that we've never seen or rarely see, that person can break right through that firewall too. And I'm thinking of an event I went to back in the 70s with Philip Berrigan, whose brother Daniel Berrigan, they were both Catholic priests of the, and they were outside, they were on the fringes, right? They were completely anti-war, pacifists, very open about their difficulties in believing the Christian faith and their struggles with being a Catholic priest. So I can't remember which brother it was, but I went to a talk by him, and it was like, so it just broke right through the firewall, because here was a person who was utterly sincere and had no bullshit. And I just spoke with another friend of mine who was there, and we hadn't talked about it in like 40 years, because we're talking about an event 40 years ago. And he remembered it just as clearly or more clearly than I did, as being something that was powerful and moving. And so I'm all for getting tipsy or a bit wasted to break through that firewall. But if we meet somebody who has a sincerity and a clarity that we've never experienced before, they can break through it too.
Mm. It's because they're powerful. It's because they're intoxicating.
Yes. Brilliantly said. They're intoxicating without an intoxicant.
All right. Yeah. It's a frequency thing. All right. If you look at the frequency pattern vibrations of fear and love, they're vastly different. One's slow and undular and graceful, and one's rapid and painful. That's the kind of thing, if you have in your heart a frequency projection of that love coming out, people, whether or not the sensitive ones, can actually feel it, right? And that's what gravitates them, that gravitas. I remember talking with Ken O'Keefe one time, and he was working as a waiter at a restaurant, and he talked about his boss and how he admired him so much, not because of car and his job title or anything like that, but because he was brilliant at what he did. He used this phrase that I think is one of the most important phrases when describing a man. A man who commands respect. Not because he commands that you respect him, but because what he does is done in such a way that anybody observing it can appreciate it and respect it for what it is in and of itself. That kind of thing, that power that is inside all of us to do something completely unique in our own way, something that nobody else is doing, and do it better than anyone. That entrepreneurial sort of life force, that essence. And I think that actually resides inside each human being, but over time we've managed to categorize and chronicle a lot of the symptoms of this brilliance that we have as a mental illness or a disorder or depression or something of that nature, right? If you're really depressed because the world is going in a really bad direction and then somebody says there's something wrong with you, it's not because there's actually something wrong with you. It's because you're right and there's something wrong with the world and they're trying to confuse you. That's another thing that psychopaths do. They create an alternate reality, a blatant lie right in front of you that you know to be untrue because you have seen the truth and you know that they're lying. And it makes you start to question reality itself. It makes you start to question what you can see yourself. That's how they get you, like into a trance, as opposed to that other intoxication that we talked about. Maybe that's the great war that's been going on human beings the whole time. The angelic, inspirational, higher self human and the corrupted, destroyed and distraught, psychopathic, cruel and talentless human.
Right. And so then we start asking, where are the islands of sanity, if you will, that people are attracted to, that they can be their higher selves, or at least have some protection from the madness. And I was speaking about these two American priests, listening to you, I was reminded of the fact that when the Roman Empire started to dissolve, a lot of people just sought refuge in monasteries, and which had their own rules, right? You had to contribute, you know, if you weren't in the hierarchy, you worked at the monastery's gardens or whatever. But there were still refuges because there was a wall, there was a firewall around the monastery that it was left alone for a variety of reasons. And so listening to you, I think you've described something that's really important for those of us that feel alone, is we need to find the equivalent of a monastery. And it can be online if there's nothing else, if we can't find any real people around us who feel this. The good thing about the digital world is we can find our own sort of, if you will, abstract monasteries where at least we can find like-minded souls.
Yeah. There's nothing like believing in really crazy conspiracy theories and being the only one. Oh, that's a painful experience. Vinny, do you want to come around and watch the news? No, I don't.
Right, and you can imagine what it's going to be like when the equivalent of the Roman Empire starts dissolving now, is that people will feel really lost. You know, like, wait a minute, despite all the abuses of power that I've been subjected to, I thought that there was still something there that was solid that I had to obey. And when that dissolves, then it's going to be a real shock for people. And so people who have found a community that nurtures themselves will be so much more ready, you know, for the dissolution of empire. And, you know, if history teaches us anything, it's all empires dissolve for one reason or another. You know, they may endure for 1,000 years, but they eventually dissolve. And I think with things speeded up in modern day life, I don't think anything's going to last 1,000 years.
Mm.
Maybe 5.
Well,
10 years.
The garbage that we've dumped into the Pacific Ocean might, but that's another issue.
Yes. That gyre of plastic trash will probably still be here in 1,000 years. Yes.
Well, at least the human race will leave a legacy. You know, like some sort of evidence that we were still here. You know.
Oh well, we'll have our freeway pylons. That'll be like our our pyramids. You know.
Yeah, they'll be dug up as coal in about 7 million years. You know. Future alien archaeologists just come to this like red desert planet with like these giant dried up oceans and just, what the fuck happened here?
It's amazing how many science fiction films follow up that, you know, that dystopia. But I prefer to think that we can actually, at least some of us, can encourage what you described, our angelic selves, our selves that want to connect with other people and be productive, not destructive. And so maybe that's a false hope, but I'd prefer to cling to that.
There's no such thing as a false hope. Every hope is good.
I love that.
The person who has no hope, mate, they have no strength, they have no power, they have no future. A person with any kind of hope, even the most ridiculous, insane, totally clutching at straws hope that you could conceive of, is more powerful than somebody who has nothing, right? Now, yes. This is another thing that's supposed to be trying to be eroded away from people. And ultimately, half the reason why I do this show is a form of personal therapy for me, because I hate being intelligent in a country like New Zealand
because there's so much freaking fluoride.
You know, and I need to be, essentially, there's a whole world out there that I need to be able to access, essentially. And I need to be able to access the really juicy, awesome, nougaty goodness that the world really has to offer. And I conceived of this idea, and I think, like all good ideas, somebody's already thought of it before. There's only one thing of actual value. You know, I mean, this mouse, this keyboard, this camera, this microphone, these lights, this backdrop, whatever it is, all these things that have a dollar value, they don't actually have any real value. Not the gold, not silver, not steel, not iron. It is people that have value. Them and only them. And it's interesting because it has no value that you can calculate. What's a human being worth? What's David Rockefeller worth? What's Vinnie Eastwood worth? Etc., etc. You can't really calculate that value of what a person is, except when they're gone and you realize that the value of their existence is no longer there. That's why it's so valuable. Because people can only be valued now, when they're here, right in front of you, able to talk and respond and share ideas. That, to me, is the only time when people have really been of value, is when they are alive.
Well said. And it makes me think about something that many of us have experienced, which is when we know somebody who's survived a serious cancer, they often become a human being after they've experienced a proximity to death. And suddenly they become another person, at least until they, if they continue watching TV and all that stuff, they revert to form if they live long enough. But a lot of people are profoundly transformed by that. And I think you're absolutely right. We're so conditioned to quantify everything. And experience really can't be quantified. It can't be explained. We're really talking about that desire to be a fully human being, you know. And how do we nurture that? And I think you described it better than I can. But I do sense that happens when people experience sincerity, or they experience a proximity to death, or they experience a trauma, as you described earlier.
Yep, and again, it's the great cosmic irony. That which is almost going to kill you is going to be that which makes you value your life and make you feel alive after the fact. The things that give you the greatest pleasure and enjoyment, etc., are actually the greatest distractions from that trauma and pain, which could give you the most valuable lessons, because the only lessons of value will be those that cost you a lot.
Yes, that's so true.
Not the lessons that get you into a lot of a debt that you have to, like, work on for a long, long time after.
God damn, we were drowning in student debt. It's like, hey, I'm really young and I haven't even gotten a job yet and I don't even know what the world is. I just came out of a straight mind control institution and go straight into a college institution into another form and get myself into a lifelong form of debt so I can go and work at Walmart getting minimum wage to pay off my enormous student debt that I accumulated for learning bullshit that I never actually got to use, even while I was employed at Walmart. The stupidity.
All right. Charles Smith has been my very special guest. Your website, please, quickly before we go to break.
Of2minds.com.
Of2minds.com.
I'm waiting there.
All right. Thank you very much, Charles. And thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for donating. We will see you again sometime in the Vinny Eastwood Show.com. Leave a comment, give us a like, and share around all these broadcasts. Thank you. We'll see you again sometime, folks.